Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Jonathan Lear, the John U. Neff Distinguished Professor in the Committee on Social Thought in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Chicago, and author of several books, including Aristotle, The Desire to Understand, Open-Minded, Working Out the Logic of the Soul, Therapeutic Action, An Earnest Plea for Irony, and Radical Hope, Ethics in the Face of Cultural Devastation. He'll deliver the 31st Annual Henri J. Renard S.J. Endowed Lecture in Philosophy, co-sponsored by the Creighton University Department of Philosophy. The topic of his lecture will be, Why Does Irony Matter? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 22, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Kevin Graham, Associate Professor and Chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Creighton University.
Father Renard was a beloved teacher and scholar at Creighton University, taught philosophy here for many years. The lecture is named after him, and it's one of the most important events in the life of our philosophical community every year, and so we're very pleased that you've come to join us. Some philosophy programs like to encourage their faculty to be fairly narrow specialists and really go very deep in a very small area. Generally speaking, we like to encourage folks to have broader interests that touch in a number of different areas in philosophy. Some philosophy programs like to encourage their faculty to really get focused on debates that matter very much to philosophers, regardless of whether they speak at all to society more broadly. We try to encourage our faculty and our students to think about issues that really speak to public life and the concerns of culture more broadly. That's why Dr. Jonathan Lear is your Renard lecturer tonight. Dr. Lear's scholarly interests are wide-ranging. He has published many widely acclaimed books in areas as diverse as philosophy of logic, epistemology, philosophy of psychology and psychiatry, moral philosophy. He's in demand as a lecturer among faculties and learned societies in areas such as history, psychology, psychiatry, law, theology, as well as philosophy. The title of tonight's lecture is Why Does Irony Matter? And I'm pleased to present to you the 31st Renard lecturer, Dr. Jonathan Lear.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. So on a cold, dark evening in the middle of winter, sitting in the audience and looking down at a handout, one's heart might sink at the thought of having been snagged once again by a zippy title into a dull talk. And there's special pain when the talk is on irony. How could a speaker succeed in making irony dull? Well, I make no promises. Well, other than this one, I'm going to spare you a list of the pros and cons of whether Socrates was a deceiver. Now, why should irony matter, philosophically speaking? In the epilogue to his book, Socrates, Ironist and Moral Philosopher, the marvelous Gregory Vlastos says, "In the whole of the Platonic corpus, nay, in the whole of our corpus of Greek prose or verse, no happier life than Socrates's may be found," unquote. Now, I think every step of his argument is mistaken, but he nevertheless got to the right conclusion. When properly understood, irony is intimately linked to human happiness, and both are linked to the sort of ignorance that Socrates professed. Now, I don't think any of this is well understood. And equally important, contemporary moral psychology and the moral philosophy that emerges from it is, I think, dominated by an inadequate conception of psychic unity and self-consciousness. And this distorts our understanding of agency, freedom, and rationality. And I think a proper understanding of irony can bring all of this into view. And perhaps surprisingly, I have found that to get to a proper understanding, one needs to take seriously the Freudian unconscious. So in this lecture, I would like first to give an account of irony as a peculiar form of uncanniness. And I'm going to explain that. And second, I'm going to link this ironic uncanniness to the psychoanalytic unconscious. And finally, I'm going to give at least a preliminary indication of why this matters, philosophically speaking. Now, let me say a word about what I mean by a proper understanding of irony. Obviously, people can call all sorts of related phenomena irony. And if the use sticks, you can eventually read about it in the Oxford English Dictionary. The OED aspires to give an authoritative account of the historical uses of the word, and it can seem as though there's nothing more to find out. After all, isn't meaning use? The idea that one still needs to grasp what irony really is can look like mystifying hokum. And yet, what if the OED gives us the history of our routines with the word irony? But that there is also a phenomenon that underlies, escapes, and disrupts these routines. What if this little disruptor is crucial to the human condition? Now, in my opinion, irony is revealed neither by a majority vote of those who use the term, nor by a glimpse of a transcendent idea, but by a grasp of of what should matter when it comes to living a distinctively human life. Now, this, I believe, is the route that Kierkegaard took, and he credits Socrates as his teacher. But what Kierkegaard learned from Socrates, I think, is itself a source of some confusion. Now, perhaps because he was a religious thinker, Kierkegaard certainly tends to be passed over in contemporary secular philosophy departments. And on the occasion when one wants to know his views about Socratic irony, it has been become customary to consult his book, The Concept of Irony, with continual reference to Socrates. But that book was literally a student thesis. He submitted it for his magister's, basically his master's degree. I mean, think of you being remembered by your, senior thesis. The mature Kierkegaard came to think of this book as the misguided view of a very young man. In concluding on scientific postscript, the pseudonymous author that pours scorn on the young Kierkegaard, he says, Magister Kierkegaard, on the other hand, has scarcely understood Socrates, as can be inferred from his dissertation. His dissertation is The Concept of Irony. So we have the situation of, contemporary philosophers going back to this book that Kierkegaard himself rejected. In general, the philosophical reception of the problem of Socratic irony has been unironic about its own activity. The debate is focused on whether or not Socrates is dissembling, wearing a mask, saying the opposite of what he means. Now, how has this come to be the debate? Well, at various points in the Platonic dialogues, some of Socrates' more challenging interlocutors, Alcibiades, Thrasymachus, and Callicles, they each accuse Socrates of deploying his typical ironia. And that Greek term from which the English term irony descends does mean putting on a mask, dissimulation. Although there can be complex, nuanced levels of masking, and thus lots of room for nuance and interpretation, it nevertheless seems that ultimately, and this I emphasize seems, it seems that ultimately there are only two positions, either to agree with the charge that's leveled against Socrates, that he's dissembling or putting on a mask, or to disagree by interpreting the text in such a way that Socrates is no deceiver. Now, Kierkegaard, as I understand him, broke through this either-or. He had his eye on the fact that Thrasymachus, Callicles, and Alcibiades are all unreliable narrators. Each in his own way is a brilliant but flawed character. So one should expect them to be focusing on something, that's their brilliance, when they make their charge, but to have a distorted view of what that something is. In his What I take to be Kierkegaard's irony about irony, Kierkegaard treats Thrasymachus, Callicles, and Alcibiades as though they were involved in a kind of naming ceremony. And he lets their use of the word ironia fix rigidly onto the activity of Socrates, whatever that is that elicits the criticism from his interlocutors. He does not expect them, the interlocutors, to understand what that activity is. And then Kierkegaard asks, what was Socrates actually doing? And the answer to that question is, for the mature Kierkegaard, what Socratic irony is. Well, not quite. For the mature Kierkegaard, what it is to learn from Socrates is not to write an academic treatise explaining the marks and features of Socratic irony, but it is to be ironic in the service of helping oneself and one's readers move in the direction of virtue. Thus, instead of a later academic work in which he revises his earlier views on irony, we have the creation of pseudonymous authors who go on to write and edit their own ironic and humorous texts. And the aim of these texts is not to explain irony, but to instill it. Now, on December 3rd, 1854, and that is 13 years after he submitted the concept of irony as his thesis, and it was 1 year before his death, and it was about 156 years ago, Kierkegaard wrote in his journal an entry in which he distinguishes a situation in which there is no irony at all from a situation in which there is what he calls, quote, the most intense irony, unquote. Quote, my entire existence is really the deepest irony. To travel to South America, to descend into subterranean caves, to excavate the remains of extinct animal types and antediluvian fossils, in this there is nothing ironic, for the animals extant there now do not pretend to be the same animals. But to excavate in the middle of Christendom, in quotes, the type of being a Christian, the types of being a Christian, which in relation to present Christians are somewhat like the bones of the extinct animals to animals living now. Now, this is the most intense irony. The irony of assuming Christianity exists at the same time that there are 1,000 preachers robed in velvet and silk and millions of Christians who beget Christians and so on. In what did Socrates' irony really lie? In expressions and turns of speech, etc.? No, such trivialities, even his virtuosity in talking ironically, such things do not make a Socrates. No, his whole existence is and was irony. And whereas the entire contemporary population of farmhands and businessmen and so on, all those thousands were perfectly sure of being human and knowing what it means to be a human being, Socrates was beneath them, ironically, and he occupied himself with the problem, what does it mean to be a human being? He thereby expressed that actually the treban of those thousands was a hallucination, tomfoolery, ruckus, a hubbub, busyness. Socrates doubted that one is a human being by birth. To become human or to learn what it means to be human does not come that easily, unquote. Now, in this passage, irony is a form of existence, indeed a form that takes up one's whole existence, and he ascribes it to Socrates and to himself. And in the case of Socrates, the contrast is between, as he puts it, the entire contemporary population who is, quote, perfectly sure of being human and knowing what it means to be human, and Socrates, whose whole existence seems to be a form of not being perfectly sure. It is crucial to understanding this entry that one not simply assume that the divide between those who are perfectly sure and those who are not perfectly sure coincides with the division between unreflective and reflective life. I think we caricature the contemporary population if we think of them going through life unreflectively. And the Platonic dialogues are full of people reflecting on their lives. For example, at the beginning of the Republic, when Socrates asks the aged merchant Cephalus what has been the value of living a life organized around acquiring wealth, Cephalus has clearly thought about it, and he has a fascinating and confident answer. And for some of us, we self-conscious creatures who inhabit universities, we reflecting on our lives may be the way that we manifest that we are perfectly sure about what it means to be human. So But if reflection is not itself sufficient to get one out of this hubbub and busyness and tomfoolery and illusion, then the root out is not a trivial matter. And Kierkegaard named that root out irony. Now, for Kierkegaard, the occasion for, quote, the most intense irony arises from trying to figure out the types of being a Christian by excavating as what he calls, quote, in the middle of Christendom, unquote. Kierkegaard used the term Christendom to refer to socially established institutions of Christianity, the ways in which understandings of Christianity are embedded in social rituals, customs, and practices. And so the picture here is of a person trying to reflect on the types of being a Christian by consulting church histories, received accounts of the division of the church into sects, accounts in sermons, books, editorials, and articles about Christian life. Now, it's easy enough to caricature this man's activity in the quote, but I think if you caricature it, you miss the power of irony. The power of irony emerges when one portrays this person as a much more serious figure. And though our reflection thus far has been third personal, it's important to keep in mind that for him, this reflector, it's an important first personal question about how he should live and be and what he should believe. So imagine it's me. I am engaged in what I take to be the practical task of living up to the demands of a particular practical identity, in this case, being a Christian. But I am doing so by working my way through Christendom. Note that this activity is essentially reflective, and in the familiar metaphor of contemporary philosophy, I am stepping back from ordinary life and asking what a properly Christian life consists in. And it may be undertaken in a genuine mood of sincerity and with intellectual sophistication. That I just want to keep insisting on. We shouldn't be making fun of this person or caricaturing him. Nevertheless, my reflection is a form of being, quote, perfectly sure, and this shows itself in my reliance on Christendom to give me the sort of tools for my reflection. It's that assumption that makes the irony possible. The Christendom of Kierkegaard's Europe no longer exists. I expect that many people in this audience are Christian and live a religious life, and those of you who do will live, I think, very differently from that 19th century European form, and then others are secular, they too will live differently than the Christendom of Kierkegaard's Danish 19th century Europe. And thus we, whether religious or secular, we now can step back from that Christendom and treat it as though it were an object of reflective consideration, stepping back, and as that familiar metaphor of stepping back and viewing it from some distance. But if we had been or if we were inhabitants of that Christendom, and so if our interest in the question was essentially an interest in self-knowledge, then although reflection would be possible and reflection on our practical identity as Christians would be possible and reflection on Christianity would be possible, all of that would still be acts within Christendom. Christendom, as Kierkegaard understood it, aims to be, and when it is vibrant, for the most part is, closed under reflection. And that's a technical term that, reflecting on it, you're still in it. You're taking a step back from it, you're still in it. For its inhabitants, the inhabitants of that Christendom, reflection's possible, it's even encouraged, but that's not sufficient to get outside it or genuinely to step back from it. Now, elsewhere, Kierkegaard called Christendom a quote, dreadful illusion, unquote. And I take it that he is talking not only about its degree of falsity in terms of being a representation of Christianity, but its all-encompassing nature. That's the nature of the illusion part of it. The illusion of Christendom is that it is the world of Christianity, and when it comes to Christianity, there's no outside. And its success as illusion thus depends on its ability to metabolize and contain reflection on Christian life. And then one can thus easily see that when a culture is in the grip of a vibrant illusion, I mean, whether it's about Christendom or anything else, when the culture is in the grip of a vibrant illusion, philosophical discourse about our ability to step back in reflection can function as ideology, reinforcing our confinement in the name of liberating us from it. And I see no reason for assuming that for any illusion, there's always going to be discrepancies, disagreements, contradictions within it such that reflecting on them will be sufficient to get us out of them. When Kierkegaard's Christendom was vibrant, there were plenty of discrepancies, disagreements, and contradictions, and reflecting on them was the stuff of Christendom. It was Christendom itself. Indeed, it is precisely the moment when reflective consciousness unwittingly participates in the illusion that is, you know, for Kierkegaard, the moment of, quote, the most intense irony, unquote, at least in Kierkegaard's opinion. The instance that concerned him was the one he took to be of the greatest practical importance to himself and his neighbors, trying to figure out how to be Christian. Notice that the occasion for irony arises not merely for the vain and the hypocritical, the shallow and the silly. Even if I am smart and sincerely want to think about how to be Christian, if I do so by excavating Christendom, that is engaging in reflection with the material supplied to me by Christendom, that too is an occasion for irony. Okay, so to get clear on what irony is, I want to distinguish the experience of irony from the development of a capacity from irony, and to distinguish that from what Kierkegaard calls ironic existence. And in a nutshell, the experience of irony is a peculiar experience that is essentially first personal, not simply in the sense that all experience is the experience of some I, but that in having an experience of irony, I experience myself as confronted by that very experience. Developing a capacity for irony is developing the capacity to occasion an experience of irony, either in oneself or in another. An ironic existence is whatever it is that is involved in turning this capacity for irony into a human excellence, a virtue. The capacity for deploying irony in the right way, in the right time, in the living of a distinctively human life. It is ironic existence that Kierkegaard describes to Socrates and to himself, and it is ironic existence that manifests the Socratically happy life. But for now, I just want to take two steps back from that and focus in on the experience of irony. As we saw in that quote, Kierkegaard makes a constitutive contrast using an archaeological metaphor, but we don't need to go on an imagined trip or even an imagined dig. If, say, a duck were waddling across a courtyard here at Creighton, it doesn't matter whether the bones of its ancient ancestors are buried under the ground. And the reason is that the duck, in its waddle, is not thereby pretending to be the same as its ancestors. And here is the pivot point of irony. It becomes possible when when one encounters animals who pretend. And pretending animals, this is a distinctively human form of life. Now, when Kierkegaard says that other animals don't pretend, he's not making a point about make-believe. Rather, he's using pretend in the older sense of put oneself forward or make a claim. These are older meanings, and it's in the Danish as well as the English. Think of the pretender to a throne. She is putting herself forward as the legitimate heir to the throne. Now, in this most elemental sense, pretense goes to the heart of human agency. Human self-consciousness is constituted by our capacity to pretend in this literal and non-pejorative sense. In general, we can say what we are doing. And in doing that, the ability to just say what we're doing, whether it's tying your shoes or giving a lecture or listening to a lecture, in doing that, we are making a claim about what we are up to. Now, of course, the capacity for pretense opens out in myriad ways in occupying social roles, maintaining a sense of identity, declaring our beliefs, and so on. In pretense, we put ourselves forward as up to something or other, and we put ourselves up to something or other as somehow good, up to something somehow or other good. It's good to tie my shoes. The possibility of irony arises when a gap opens up between pretense as it is made available in social practice and an aspiration or ideal which, on the other hand, is embedded in the pretense. Indeed, it expresses what the pretense is all about, but which, on the one hand, it seems to transcend the life and the social practice in which the pretense is made. But everything depends on how this gap is brought to self-conscious awareness. Now, Kierkegaard's fundamental ironic question is, number one, Kierkegaard's fundamental ironic question is, one, in all of Christendom, is there a Christian? Or to put it more bluntly, among all Christians, is there a Christian? And it's a striking fact about us that we can immediately hear that there is a question being asked rather than a meaningless repetition. The form of the question is a tautology, and yet we do not hear it as a tautology. And I think it's a revealing fact about us that this should be so. The question asks of a purported totality whether any of its members live up to the aspirations which purportedly characterize that totality. Now, if by contrast you were to ask, or we were to ask, among all the ducks, is there a duck? It's not clear what, if anything, is being asked. We have no, we can't hear the question. unlike human life, duck life does not involve pretense. Now, of course, we may make claims on behalf of the ducks. A master chef standing in front of a pond and planning this evening's canard à l'orange may utter just such a sentence. Oh, among all these ducks, is there a duck? But it would not be based on any of the claims that the ducks were making, right? It would be based on claims we're making about ducks. Now, irony for Kierkegaard opens up a gap between pretense and aspiration in a way that is meant to grab us. And this is the crucial part. It is this way of being grabbed when we are so grabbed, and I think that's rarely, but it is this way of being grabbed that is so tricky to capture, and yet it is it's crucial to the experience of irony, as I understand it. The ironic question on its own, like number one, the ironic question on its own is neither necessary nor sufficient to generate an experience of irony, and it's important that this should be so. Now, in ordinary Christian practice, right in the middle of the Christendom that Kierkegaard deplored, one might well, a priest might well use a sentence, or you know, or a reverend might well use a sentence like, in all of Christendom, is there a Christian, in an absolutely straightforward reflection in which you step back from the practices and you question them in the familiar way. And one might even call this reflection irony or ironic. But philosophically speaking, I think you'd be using the term in a derivative sense. And by calling that turn of phrase irony, one might thereby hide from oneself that anything is missing. And I'm trying to capture this missing thing. So how might a question like one be an occasion for the experience of irony? So let us develop Kierkegaard's example. I spend Sunday morning listening to a sermon on how we fail to live up to the ideal of loving one's neighbor as oneself. I leave the church and I pass a beggar. I pull out my wallet and I give him a dollar, and he says, quote, "That is a very Christian thing of you to do," unquote. What is he saying? We'll never know. Perhaps he is just thanking me. Perhaps he is just thanking me. But perhaps he is being ironic in this familiar sense of irony, namely saying the opposite of what he means so that I will recognize that he thinks I'm a cheapskate. Thus far, we haven't left Christendom. I should have given him a 20 in his view, you know, so what a Christian thing of you to do. Okay, that's the familiar irony. But I want to try to capture a very different experience, one in which these words shake me. Who knows why, but this time, his words are not simply an occasion for further reflection on my Christian life. They are an occasion of disruption and disorientation. It is as though Christianity has come back to show me that everything I have hitherto taken to be Christian life is ersatz, shallow. And even when I am pricked by conscience and experience myself as falling short, that entire package that I learned, I'm back in Kierkegaard's world, I learned in Christendom now seems to bear at best a comical relation to what it would actually be to follow Jesus' teaching. Now, notice I use the very same terms as I used before, but I am disoriented with respect to them. I seem to be already committed to them. They go to the heart of who I take myself to be, and yet my disorientation is itself a manifestation that I do not yet know what they really mean. Now, so thus the experience of irony thus seems to be a peculiar species of uncanniness in this sense, the sense that something that has been familiar to me returns to me as strange and unfamiliar. And in its return as unfamiliar, it disrupts my world. That is, my whole life has been oriented as a Christian life, but in this moment, I no longer know what it means. The experience of uncanniness is thus enhanced dramatically when what is returning to me as unfamiliar is what until now I have taken to be who I am or who I want to be. And this is, I think, what makes irony compelling. It's the mirror, I think it's one way to think about this is it's the mirror image of an oracle. An oracle begins with an outside source telling a person who he is in terms that he first finds alien and enigmatic. And then there's a sort of uncanny, unsettling process of familiarization. The person comes to understand what the oracle means as he comes to recognize that he is indeed its embodiment. And of course, the recognition of the meaning of the oracle represents more than a kind of increase in propositional knowledge. You know, for example, it turns out that I am the man who murdered his father and married his mother. I mean, that's sort of, you know, Oedipus, it's hardly an increase in, you know, his recognition of the oracle is hardly an increase in propositional knowledge. It's the occasion for the disruption of my sense of who I am and a disorientation in a world that until now has been familiar. Now, with this robust form of irony that I'm trying to isolate, the movement's in the opposite direction. A person gives a familiar designation to himself. He takes on a practical identity, and as the irony unfolds, not only does the designation become weirdly unfamiliar, one suddenly experiences oneself as disrupted, and in that disruption, call to who knows, you know, one knows not what, though one would use the same language as before, to being a Christian. Now, oracles depend for their power on the structure and ambiguity of their wording, so it's worth noting that the basic form of this ironic question has the structure of uncanniness. You see, like in number one, the first occurrence of the term in the sentence, I mean, among all Christians, that's the first part of the, I guess I don't have it written down there. This is the variation I want to use. The first occurrence of the term in the sentence, among all Christians, gives us the pretense, the familiar. But the second occurrence gives us the aspiration, is there a Christian? Among all Christians, pretense, is there a Christian aspiration? But that aspiration, that second occurrence, is also a repetition and return of Christianity, this time is somewhat strange, enigmatic, and unfamiliar. Of course, the ironic question on its own does not guarantee ironic uptake, the experience of irony. But when that experience does occur, it's got the structure of uncanniness. Now, I've been working with Kierkegaard's example of Christendom, but it's very important to note that the possibility for irony does not depend on the religious nature of the example. We've already seen that the experience of irony has two moments. First, there's the bringing out of a gap between pretense and pretense transcending aspiration. And then there's this experience of ironic uptake that I've suggested as a peculiar species of uncanniness. And now it's time to bring into relief a crucial feature of irony, namely, that in the paradigm case, it is radically first personal present tense. In the paradigm case, for each I, irony is something that disrupts me now. This may at first seem strange because the basic form of the ironic question doesn't explicitly have the first person pronoun in it. However, for the question to hit its target, for it to be the occasion of this ironic uptake, for some particular I, there must be a kind of first personal disruption. So I am sitting home in the evening grading papers of my students, and I begin to wonder, like I'm on the fourth test I'm correcting, fourth essay, what does this actually have to do with teaching my students? Now, for a while, this is a normal reflection in which I step back and I wonder about the value of my activity. I still have a sense of what the ideal is. I'm just reflecting on how well the activity of grading contributes to it. But then things start to get out of hand. I'm struck by teaching in a way that disrupts my normal self-understanding of what it is to teach, which includes normal reflection on teaching. This is not a continuation of my practical reasoning. It's a disruption of it. It's more like vertigo than a process of stepping back to reflect. When it comes to previous received understandings of teaching, even those that have been reflectively questioned and adjusted in the normal way, all bets are off. Now, no doubt I can still use phrases like, well, I'm helping my students to develop. But such phrases have become enigmatic and even open-ended and oracular themselves. I no longer know who my students are, let alone what it would be to help them develop. Are my students the individuals coming into my classroom at the appointed time, or are they to be located elsewhere? Are they in the younger generation, or they're my age or older? Might they come along in a different generation altogether, maybe in the next century? And if my classroom is where my students are, where's my classroom? What am I to make of the room I'm actually walking into now? Where should I encounter my students? What would it be to encounter them? And if I were to encounter them, what would it be to help them rather than harm them? What is development? Now, already I have enough questions to last a lifetime, and I don't even know where to begin. Now, in this ironic moment, my practical knowledge is disrupted. I can no longer say in any detail what the requirements of teaching consist in, nor do I have any idea of what to do next. That is why, in the ironic moment, I am called to a halt. Nothing any longer makes sense to me as the next step I might take as a teacher. I might understand what the I may well continue to understand what the social norms of teaching still require. I mean, I haven't gone absolutely mad. I know that, you know, qua social form, I'm supposed to continue grading the papers. But what I've lost a sense of is what any of that has to do with teaching. Now, ironic disruption is thus a species of uncanniness, and I now like calling it the Unheimlich maneuver. The life and identity that I have hitherto taken as familiar has suddenly become unfamiliar. And however, there is this difference. In an ordinary experience of the uncanny, there is this mere disruption. The familiar is suddenly and disruptively experienced as unfamiliar. But what is peculiar to irony is that it manifests a passion for a certain direction. It is because I care about teaching that I have come to a halt as a teacher. In this moment, the uncanny disruption is the form that my caring about teaching takes. I have a strong desire to be moving in a certain direction, becoming and being a teacher, but I lack orientation. And thus the experience of irony is, I think, an experience of, I call it, would-be directed uncanniness. Now, it's often assumed that irony is a form of detachment. I mean, I think that's the familiar contemporary understanding of irony as detachment. But from the perspective of, and from the perspective of those who are embedded in the social pretenses, who don't get what's going on with me in this moment I'm describing, it may well appear that irony is a form of detachment, a lack of commitment or seriousness. For after all, it is a form of peculiar detachment from the social pretense. When things go well, it might serve or it will serve as an occasion for a peculiar form of reattachment. But if, in one's blinkered view, social pretense is all there is, then it's easy to view irony as it regularly is viewed. Lear hasn't handed in his grades. Typical. And now he's jabbering on about not knowing how to grade. Of course he knows how to grade. He's just being ironic. It would be better if we had a colleague who was committed to teaching, unquote. My colleague. To the socially embedded, it's precisely this manifestation of commitment that's going to appear as a lack of commitment, perhaps even as dissembling or sarcasm, and that, of course, is how Socrates appeared to many of his interlocutors. Now, if we try to capture what's really going on with me, the language that suggests itself is that of Platonic eros, that I am struck by teaching, by an intimation of its goodness, and I am filled with longing to grasp what it is and to incorporate it into my life. I can no longer simply live with the available social understandings of teaching. If I am to return to social understandings, it's got to be in a different way. And thus the initial intuition is that there must be something more to teaching than what's available in the social pretense. And thus I think irony also can be seen as an outbreak of pretense transcending aspiring. The experience of ironic uncanniness is the form that pretense transcending aspiring takes. And because there is embedded in this experience an itch for direction, an experience of uncanny, enigmatic longing, it's appropriate to conceive the experience of irony as an experience of you know, would-be directed erotic uncanniness. That's what I think the experience of irony is. And so the experience of irony operates in us very similar to Socrates' daimon, that in the moment of uncanny anxiety, we are called to a halt. It is as though something about the goodness of what I am purportedly up to has come to disrupt what I am actually up to. And the disturbance is not just happening to me. In the most fundamental sense, it is about me and in me. I seem to be directed by a ghostly twin of a principle around which I have been shaping my life and identity. As is well known, Plato offered a metaphysics and psychology that interpreted such moments of erotic breakthrough as a response to a call of an external transcendent ideal. I have nothing to say about that. I don't know about that. It's not like I think he's wrong. I just don't know. I'm saying nothing about that either way. But what I do want to claim is that we can nevertheless, whatever the truth of Platonism is, we can nevertheless understand such experiences imminently as arising from some deep part of ourselves, calling us to a good that transcends the goodness with which we have hitherto organized our lives. Now, suppose that we were to take seriously Freud's suggestion that the experience of uncanniness represents some sort of a breakthrough from the unconscious. As he put it, suppose, you know, as Freud put it, the uncanny, the unheimlich, is something which is secretly familiar, which has undergone repression and then returned from it. Obviously, we would no longer need to invoke a spiritual daimon to explain the experience, and less obviously, there would be significant consequences for our understanding of the unconscious and for our philosophical understanding of moral psychology. And in the remainder of today's lecture, I'd like to explore briefly these consequences. Now, Kantians tend to think that even if there is such a thing as the repressed unconscious, it poses no special problem for our understanding of psychic unity, autonomy, and morality. After all, if some desire pops into my conscious awareness, why should it matter where it comes from, whether it be from my unconscious or anywhere else? On occasion, I become aware I'm hungry. On another occasion, perhaps with help from my analyst, I become aware of longings for a relationship with my father, of which I was hitherto unaware. The same question confronts me in both cases. What am I going to do about that? Or what should I think about that? Now, from a Kantian perspective, whatever the item, it's all just grist for the mill of reflective consciousness. Now, this argument, I think, looks persuasive because it assumes a particular division of form and matter, that whatever comes into conscious awareness, whether it was previously unconscious or not, is the matter on which reflective consciousness now can impose its form. And insofar as reflective consciousness succeeds in imposing a form, it succeeds in crafting or authoring unity. Now, it's precisely this conception of form and matter that the experience of irony, as I have interpreted it, calls into question. For if in the moment of uncanny anxiety I am being called into question, and if I am being called into question by my own ghostly twin, or by the ghostly twin of a principle by which I live, and if the source of this upset is my unconscious, it would seem as though my unconscious is trying to impose its form on me. Now, I want to make four claims. First, unconscious fantasy is often a highly articulated structure pervading a person's life and providing an organizing source of psychic unity. It's not simply a matter of a forbidden wish intruding upon an otherwise organized psyche. Conflict between this unconscious source of the self and conscious identity can be the occasion for an outbreak of uncanny anxiety. And this sort of conflict can never be adequately resolved simply by self-conscious reflection. For secondly, the Freudian unconscious is its own form of thinking. It differs in form from reflective self-conscious thinking, and Freud himself insisted upon this. Thus, the unconscious cannot be adequately understood in terms of repressed contents that become available for self-conscious reflection. And thus, this process of making the unconscious conscious cannot exclusively consist in bringing items like wishes and fantasies before the scrutiny of self-conscious reflection. It also crucially consists in a kind of self-conscious participation in the item itself, the expression of the fantasy in the right sort of a way. And third, any genuine psychic unity available to humans must be a unity that encompasses these very different forms of thinking. This unity cannot be achieved by reflective self-consciousness deciding what it thinks about this or that form of activity, as though it were judging whether or not to act on a wish or a desire. And finally, the last claim, in its own peculiar way, the unconscious acts as its own formal principle, treating self-conscious mental life as its matter. Thus, the philosophically significant conflict between reflective self-consciousness and unconscious mental activity is not about repressed contents. That's what I think. It's a conflict, rather, between two distinct forms of mental activity, each of which seeks to take the other as its matter. So to achieve true psychic unity, it thus cannot be a matter of imposing self-conscious form on a hitherto unconscious matter. It must consist in finding roots of accommodation between differing forms of mental activity. Now, to make the case for these four claims is, I think, a life's work. And here I'm only going to point in the direction that I think an interpretation should take. From early on, Freud insists that the unconscious cannot be understood in terms of repressed contents, but must be grasped as an alternative form of mental activity. In his essay, The Unconscious, he insists that the unconscious is a peculiar form of thinking. It works according to what he calls primary psychical process, in which there are loose and weird associations among ideas, transfers of psychic energy across these connections. Unconscious processes are timeless, that is, there are no tenses to the verbs, nor do they even try to conform to the law of non-contradiction, the hallmark of self-conscious thought. To sum up, exemption from mutual contradiction, primary process, timelessness, and replacement of external by psychical reality, these are the characteristics which we may expect to find in the processes belonging to the system unconscious. And in a crucial footnote in the interpretation of dreams, he warns analysts against thinking of the unconscious in terms of repressed content. Quote, at bottom, dreams are nothing other than a particular form of thinking made possible by the conditions of the state of sleep. It is the dream work which creates that form, and alone that alone is the essence of dreaming. But if the unconscious is primarily its own form of mental activity, then whatever self-conscious decision I make about a particular wish or a desire, the unconscious mental activity is going to keep on doing its thing. Genuine harmony cannot be a matter of acting only on those desires and thoughts, whatever their origin, which I can endorse from the perspective of my reflective identity. It is rather a matter of being able to think unconsciously in ways that nourish my self-conscious reflective decision-making, and conversely of being able to reflect consciously in ways that take up and make use of the unconscious thinking that I'm engaged in, no matter what. Now, an image that comes to my mind is the image of a kind of impotent judge in a B-Western movie. Now, he judges that the drunken cowboy is in contempt of court, but it doesn't make any difference. There's nobody to haul the cowboy off to jail. And even worse, somebody has slipped the judge a Mickey. He doesn't know it, but he's drunk. And as he attempts to render judgment on the cowboy, the judge manifests his own drunkenness. And this is the comedy of the unconscious. It undermines the attempt to achieve reflective distance on it by, as it were, sort of coming up from behind and manifesting itself in the very attempt to achieve reflective distance. And so if, you know, genuine harmony is going to be restored to Last Gulch, it's not going to happen through the will of the judge. It's just not going to happen that way. Now, if we think of those moments of irony that we've been considering, whether we're trying to take seriously, you know, I'm trying to take myself seriously as a Christian, a teacher, a secular liberal who respects human dignity, student, a neighbor, this familiar pattern of mental activity comes into view. At the level of self-conscious reflection, I'm earnestly trying to think through how, say, to respect the human dignity of a beggar who's just made eye contact with me. And I experience myself to be taking the available alternatives into consideration. I reflect on the various incentives, as neo-Kantians say, that they present. Now, this may trigger all sorts of, you know, superego activity. I may experience myself as falling short, perhaps wildly short, of my own commitment to dignity. But all of this, including the experience of falling short, becomes the occasion for unconscious working over of the very same category, along with all the weird associations that are made in primary process. And when it does, when, say, the ghostly twin of human dignity comes to haunt and disrupt my self-conscious musings about human dignity, in this moment, my reflective musings and all their variety, all of that comes to seem so minor. This is the experience of uncanniness that I'm trying to get. It is as though it is the unconscious, you know, in that moment where it's all experience is so minor, it's as though it's the unconscious that's taking human dignity really seriously. It's saying your conscious thinking is really not up to all that much. It is as though the unconscious is taking the step back from conscious stepping back, including my superego experience of falling short of my own ideals. And it's as though the unconscious is judging that the self-consciousness of reflective distance has in all of its complexity entirely fallen short. Now, obviously, unconscious mental activity doesn't literally have that form. It doesn't have the structure of reflective distance. But this is one way of formulating the significance of the experience of uncanny, anxious longing that is the experience of irony. And note, too, that this is not a normal superego phenomenon of falling short. Rather, it's a kind of ironic disruption of all such ordinary superego activities. So, to conclude, my aim is not to valorize disruption, but to come to a realistic philosophical understanding of what the psychic unity available to creatures like us consists in. It is one thing to say that for humans, true psychic unity is a difficult accomplishment, that it's only realized rarely in special people. It's quite another thing to fix on a false image of unity, that is, you know, one that just isn't a genuine human possibility. And the danger that concerns me is a sort of falling for a false image of unity, then idealizing it, when in fact there's no good reason for thinking that such an image ought to be an ideal. And that, I think, has been the root of much contemporary moral psychology. Korsgaard's conception of self-constitution, as well as Frankfurt's conception of wholeheartedness, to give two prominent examples, I think suffer from this false ideal. In fact, the expression psychic unity, I think, functions for us as a signifier. It points us in the direction of a phenomenon we do not well understand. And I think it's a mistake to assume we already know what psychic unity is and that the only issues are to explain how to achieve it or why it matters. The danger of assuming that we know what we are talking about when we speak about psychic unity is that we will not be able to distinguish simulacra of unity from the real thing. We tend to assume that psychic disruption must stand opposed to psychic unity, that a moment of disruption is a moment of disruption of the unity that we have achieved. But why do we think that? Perhaps certain types of psychic disruption are constitutive moments of the type of unity that is genuinely available to us. Now, obviously, this evening I've only been able to sketch out a position. And still, I hope I have said enough this evening to show you how the experience of irony, understood as uncanny, erotic, would-be directed, disrupting anxiety, how this experience might lie at the heart of the human condition. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Jonathan Lear, the John U. Neff Distinguished Professor in the Committee on Social Thought and the Department of Philosophy at the University of Chicago, and author of several books, including Aristotle, The Desire to Understand, Open-Minded, Working Out the Logic of the Soul, Therapeutic Action, An Earnest Plea for Irony, and Radical Hope, Ethics in the Face of Cultural Devastation. He has delivered the 31st Annual Henri J. Renard S.J. Endowed Lecture in Philosophy, co-sponsored by the Creighton University Department of Philosophy. The topic of his lecture was, Why Does Irony Matter? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 22, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.